Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History, and now we go over to Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands.
Well, the radio station has now been taken over. I still hope that we can get His Excellency the Governor's message to you. Sir, do you want to speak to the people?
Tell the people to wait, turning on their receivers, to wait some minutes. In some minutes, the chief is going to communicate them what we want for the population.
Well, just a minute.
Senor, un minuto!
If you take the gun out of my back, I'm going to transmit that to you. If you take the gun away. But I'm not speaking with the gun in my back. Well, there's an argument going on now between the three Argentines. They've disappeared. They've left me alone in this room.
That was the Falklands National Radio Station on the morning of the 2nd of April, 1982. And Dominic Sandbrook, that is history in the making, isn't it? Being broadcast out. That is the arrival of the Argentines on the Falkland Islands, or Las Malvinas, as the Argentines themselves would call it. And that set in train a very, very dramatic series of events that happened exactly 40 years ago. And I know that you're brimming over like a six-year-old hosting a birthday party with excitement at this.
I am. It's a great way to start, Tom, because it's starting that such a dramatic moment, such an extraordinary moment, actually, because that guy is Patrick Watts. He is broadcasting to the people of the Falkland Islands, the 1,800 people, on the Friday morning. And he's basically saying the Argentines have landed overnight. And as he's broadcasting, the Argentines burst into the studio and then they have a massive row among themselves, waving their guns around in the air. And at precisely that moment, we can't play the whole clip, but precisely at that moment, the governor of the Falklands rings up and says, "I've got very bad news. The Argentines have arrived." And it's just an absolutely... So the whole story of the Falklands War, it's the 40th anniversary. We were talking about this before we started, weren't we, Tom, about how it's a sort of combination of... It's very Churchillian in some ways, or these people think they are. It's sort of Churchill role play for the British. But at the same time, there's this bizarre kind of 1950s comedy aspect to it, which that clip actually perfectly encapsulates.
Yeah, it's the finest hour kind of rewritten by the Carry On crew or Tom Sharp or Peter Sellers or that level of... And I have to say, Dominic, that the definitive account of this... I mean, you're a wonderful writer, you're a wonderful historian, but the four chapters that you devote to the Falklands War in your most recent history of Britain, Who Dares Wins, Britain 1979 to 1982, I genuinely think is one of the great pieces of British 21st century writing.
Oh,
it's as good as anything in any novel that I've read. It's absolutely fantastic. And I think you'll remember that I was letting you know how much I was enjoying reading Who Dares Wins when it came out. But honestly, if you haven't read it, listeners, go and get it. But actually, you won't need to, because Dominic, you're basically going to do it now for us, aren't
I am,
you?
I am. Ultimately.
I mean, it is a kind of dramatic story. It's a story of military prowess, naval prowess. Lots of stuff that's been written about it focuses on the kind of the military exploits, the technical wizardry that enabled the task force to go all the way from Britain and recapture this kind of rocky outcrop in the middle of the South Atlantic. But it is also, amid the horror and the tragedy and the bloodshed, I mean, it is often a deeply comic story too, and the, full of extraordinary characters.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So Jorge Luis Borges, the brilliant Argentine writer, said it was two bald men fighting over a comb. And
do you know, I've never quite understood what that meant.
So he basically was arguing that the Falklands were completely useless and trivial, and that two sort of spent, shallow, opportunistic sort of governments were fighting over them and sacrificing people's lives for nothing. And I think that's actually, I mean, he had this sort of joke about, you know, the Bolivians have always been cross because they don't have access to the sea. So why don't we give them to Bolivia to make up for it? But of course, the thing was, with the Falklands, there were almost 2,000 people living on those islands. You know, his future
were
was
British.
At stake. Well, who thought themselves to be British.
And were they British?
They were. Well, they. I mean, they were. There were no.
So they're British passport holders?
Yeah. They are subjects of the crown.
So it's kind of like the Channel Islands or something.
Exactly. Right. We can go into the whole saga.
Okay. Let's start at the beginning. So why, what are these islands just off Argentina? I suppose they're not just off Argentina, well, are they? I mean, but let's say they're closer to Argentina than they are, say, to Southampton.
Anywhere else.
Yeah, they are. So what is the basis of the British claim
for
the Falkland Islands?
Let's get into the whole... So the Falkland Islands, for those people who have no idea what we're talking about, it's a war fought between Britain and Argentina in the spring of 1982. It's a decisive moment in the history of Argentina and its transition to democracy, in the history of Britain and the survival of the Thatcher premiership, and in Britain's sense of itself. But as you say, at the centre of it are these islands that are just miles from anywhere. And that's one of the things that gives this sort of slight comic opera aspect. So the Falklands, you said they're just off the coast of Argentina. And that is what most people think, Tom, if they think they're not in Scotland, which is what everybody thought in 1982. And we'll come on to maybe come back to that issue of whether or not they were in Scotland. So they are 500 miles from Rio Gallegos, which I think is the nearest Argentine city, the nearest sizable port. So they're not off the coast of Argentina. They're quite a long way off the coast of Argentina, but they're closer to Argentina than to anywhere else. So basically what happens is in the 18th century, these islands, which are uninhabited, which are very cold, which do look like Scottish islands or like the Faroe Islands or something.
Except they've got penguins, right?
Yeah, they do have penguins, but they're very cold. They're moorland. They have lots of sheep. But yeah, there's nothing. There's no natural resources.
Miles and miles of bugger all, Dennis Thatcher said.
Dennis Thatcher, miles and miles of bugger all. So Dr. Johnson talked of their bleak and gloomy solitude. Charles Darwin, who went to the Falkland Islands, said was struck by their desolate and wretched aspect, their peaty soil and wiry glass of one monotonous brown colour. So they're not desirable at all. But what happens in the 18th century? The English arrive first, the British rather. They
so
see
the British them discover them?
The British discover them. They basically sail past them.
So is it a Lord Falkland or somebody who's Admiral Falkland who's leading this expedition?
Lord Falkland never goes there. So the first person to go there, I think, or the first person to give the name is a guy called John Strong, who's an English captain. So I said 18th century, actually it's late 17th century, 1690, and he names them in the honour of the Treasurer of the Navy who sponsored his journey, who is Viscount Falkland.
Oh, right.
So hence you get the Falkland Islands. So, but the English, or rather the British, they don't kind of permanently settle. And actually what happens in the 18th century is the islands just keep changing hands. So the French, I think, have the first real permanent settlement. And they change hands several times. It's a very confusing and actually, you know, not an especially exciting story. But they end up with Spain, which makes sense because, of course, Spain has lots of colonies in South America. So there are lots of Spanish ships passing. So they end up with Spain. But then what happens in the Napoleonic Wars is that Spain abandons them. So there's no sort of large-scale settlement there. Why would there be? You know, if you're Spanish and you're going to the New World, you'd go on to Argentina or Uruguay.
So there's no gold or anything.
There's nothing there. So the Spanish leave in the Napoleonic Wars, but they leave a plaque. And that is very important in the sort of the talk of the claim of the islands, because the plaque says these islands are Las Malvinas and they belong to the Spanish crown. Now, what happens after that is that in 1816, the Argentina, the viceroyalty of the River Plate or whatever, declares independence from Spain because the Spanish Empire in Latin America is breaking up. And when Argentina is basically formed, the new Argentine government say, well, we get all the possessions of the Spanish Empire in this area, and that includes the Falkland Islands. And they establish a very small colony. I mean, we're talking about literally a handful of people on the islands, so in the 1820s. The people on the islands, the Spanish colony, I think they're always falling about among themselves. You know, the sort of the three men and a dog who are there.
Yeah.
And in 1833, very important day because 1983 will be the 150th anniversary of this. So in 1833, the British move in. They basically think this would be a tremendous spot for us to have a sort of base, you know, refueling, all this sort of stuff. And they establish permanent control.
And what do they do with the Spanish people who are on it?
I don't think it makes a really substantive difference.
So there isn't some kind of diplomatic protest from Spain or...
From Argentina.
From Argentina.
Oh, the Argentines don't like it, but there's nothing much they can do about it. I mean, the Argentina's politics in the 19th century is very turbulent. So the Argentines, it's not number one on the Argentine government's kind of to-do list.
And also, isn't it right that in the 19th century, and in fact, right the way into the 20th century, Argentina is a kind of unofficial colony of Britain?
Exactly. So this is the whole history of the relationship between Argentina and Britain is really, really interesting. So Argentina is a kind of informal colony of Britain. It's got all kinds of links to British business interests, shipping. Obviously, the export of beef is massively important for Argentina.
And that's how they learn football.
Football, rugby.
And indeed cricket.
Polo, cricket, gentlemen's clubs, Buenos Aires has them all. So at the end of the 19th century, if you are an English gentleman, public school educated English gentleman, you can go to Buenos Aires and feel completely at home, as you would do if you went to India or Australia or somewhere like that. There are gentlemen's clubs, there are people playing polo, there are people watching rugby, there are, as you say, you know, River Plate. I mean, the very name of the football club, one of the two great football clubs of Buenos Aires, is in English. Which tells its own story. So Argentina has this relationship with Britain that is not uncommon and is very similar to the relationship that countries have now with the United States. So on the one hand, it feels Britishness is a sort of, it connotes status and prestige and people want to have their British style suits and they want to play polo. But there's also a bit of resentment at the same time, especially, you know, for as you go lower down the social spectrum. And I think, you don't get to understand what happens with the Falklands War if you don't understand what happens with the history of Argentina. So,
right,
the Falkland Islands, yeah, there are very few people on them. I mean, I think the population peaks at about 3,000 in the interwar years, and they're all sheep farmers. That is all there is to do.
But in the context of the British Empire and Britannia ruling the waves, is it significant, strategically significant, while Britain has an empire? Because there's also there's an island called South Georgia, right, which is even further. Yes. Into the Atlantic, and that also plays a part in this story.
Yeah, there's also Southern Thule, which is even...
That's such a romantic name.
Which is even further away. Southern Thule is 1,200 miles south of Stanley, and I think South Georgia is about 800 miles east of Stanley.
I mean, South Georgia is famous for the role it plays in Shackleton,
exactly.
The great Antarctic explorer. But, I mean, are these islands really anything more than a forward base for Antarctic exploration?
Not really. Not really.
They play a role in the First World War, don't they?
There's a battle, yes.
There's a battle there.
Yes, exactly. So in the event of a war, of a naval war, so yes, these are important. There's all kinds of, you know, shenanigans in the First World War, sort of searching for German ships and all this kind of carry on. But that only really matters in the event of a war. Generally, you know, if you're into whaling, then South Georgia is very good. If you're into Antarctic exploration, if you want to have it there, you want to have a base to refuel and stuff. But you can live perfectly well without it. I mean, it's not like this is a central part of some colossal geopolitical game of risk.
So going into the post-war years, as the British Empire fades away, as colonies get given up, as British naval power retreats, the Falkland Islands are a kind of geopolitical appendix, or coccyx. They're a kind of...
That's exactly what... They're exactly just kind of, what they are.
So they don't really serve any purpose.
They're the remnants,
the remnants of a former...
of a prehistoric tale.
Yes.
That's exactly what they are.
Yeah.
So, and that's not uncommon, Tom. I mean, the Pacific is littered with islands.
Well, the
like
French
this.
Have a lot of them.
The French have lots of them. The Americans do. I mean, Guam or whatever. Yeah. I mean, you could argue Hawaii is a much bigger...
Well, we talked about Hawaii, didn't we? I mean, that should probably be British.
Of course it should.
We the cricket playing Anglicans.
Yeah. I mean, what's basically happened is if you were... There's no need to delve too deep into imperialism for this. What's happened is the human race has expanded massively over every corner of the earth. And in the 19th century, European colonial powers have basically taken every little sort of two-bit atoll they've established, if they can.
Planted a flag.
Planted a flag. And the Falklands, they've done that. And then some people have turned up to farm sheep. Now, some people have been there for generations. They are hundreds of miles from anywhere. I mean, they don't want independence. They can't have independence because they're not self-sufficient. Everything has to be imported.
Okay, so let's say we get to 1980.
Right, that's a big leap. Yeah, go on. I guess we do have to get through this in less than 10 podcasts. So.
There are about 2,000 people.
Yeah, 1,800.
All of them British, who are going back generations. So, I mean, they've been there since 1833, some of them.
Some of them are, not all of them. They have so there's nothing to do on the Falkland Islands. So if you're young, you know, you can't, often you want to get out. So famously what happens is that sort of, there's a very small Royal Marine garrison.
And so
the girls marry the Royal Marines and go off because they're the bright lights of, you know, Chelmsford or whatever.
In your book, you quote the BBC Latin America correspondent talking about the Falklands, and he says, a lot of drunkenness, a high divorce rate, and a shortage of women, which doesn't...
Yeah. No, it doesn't really...
Okay. But, Dominic, it is nevertheless, when we look at the politics of this, the geopolitics of this, I mean, it is a fact that these people have been there and that these islands have been British for almost 150 years. So that's older than many countries.
Yeah, of course. So there's no minority. So there's no indigenous people, and nor is there any sort of, you know, this is not kind of Northern Ireland or something. There's no community that wants union with Argentina.
Yeah.
As we'll see in just a second, the islanders are dead against any union with Argentina. Now, for the Argentines, the Falklands have loomed larger and larger as the 20th century has gone on, not for any strategic reason, not because any Argentine really has ever visited the Falklands but it's this kind of symbol.
A totem. But does it specifically serve as a totem of casting off Britain? So that kind of legacy of oppressive British cultural and economic influence. And so in a sense, you know, and we see this, say, with Iran or with Russia, that Britain has a notoriety above its straitened station.
Agreed. That Britain is kind of, I think the resentment of Britain is a kind of shorthand in it. In and of itself for something else, which is that Argentina had got an extraordinary history because it had entered the 20th century as one of the world's 10 richest countries and a country that appeared set fair to be a real player in the 20th century. I mean, it's got this beef industry that is incredibly lucrative, and it's got Buenos Aires, which is a massively expanding, you know, European-style city, Italian immigrants pouring in, everything seems set fair. And Argentina then has an awful 20th century, which nobody had really expected because the industry on which it didn't, you know, food prices collapse because of the First World War and they never really recover. And it becomes torn apart by all kinds of instability. So from about the 1940s and 50s, when you had Juan Perón, the sort of populist nationalist, you know,
husband
of Evita, he had waved the flag of the Falklands, and he'd basically sort of said, Argentina has been mutilated. You know, we have been, part of our birthright has been taken from us by these, and they always would call them us pirates. So all stuff.
So like Drake or something.
Yeah. By these English pirates who have stolen that Las Malvinas, and we will never be whole until they are returned. And there would be billboards or posters in the late 1940s and 1950s in Buenos Aires saying, you know, English pirates, give us back the Malvinas. And so it's sort of, as you say, it becomes a totem. Argentina then has this absolutely hellish 1970s. So Perón, who had been kicked out, he comes back in 73, 74. He's a bit of a wreck. He dies. His wife, Isabel, becomes leader of Argentina. She's then kicked out by the army. And then they have the junta, and the Argentine military junta. So they are presiding over a dirty war against their own people. They are kind of throwing people out of helicopters over the Atlantic Ocean. They're shooting and torturing poets and dissidents and trade unionists.
And this is the backdrop to Jorge Bergoglio, who later becomes Pope Francis.
Yeah.
He's head of the Jesuits there. And
he is indeed.
Relations that's, are kind of much debated, I think.
You've done well to get Christianity in, Tom. I didn't think you've done.
Well, I thought it was important. But Dominic, could I read a top historian on...
Go on.
On the generals of the junta, the officers of the junta.
Yeah, do.
They were very good at launching coups, wearing sunglasses and murdering dissidents. But in some cases, their only experience of combat had been to apply electrodes to the genitals of left-wing poets.
That
top historian was none other than yourself.
It was myself. Yeah, it was
who
me.
Dares win. So I mean, that basically sums them up.
They're not good guys.
They're not good guys. And one of the themes that you bring out brilliantly in your book is the way in which, I mean, if you wanted to have a colonial war in the 1980s, a period where it would seem that colonial wars are, you know, not the kind of thing that you go in for, the Argentine junta is basically ideal. I mean, they're terrible. They're terrible people. They torture and maim, as you say, left-wing poets.
Yeah.
They're not very good at fighting, are they? I mean, they haven't had a huge amount of experience of it.
They have never really fought anybody other than their own people.
And so, they're kind of grotesque. They have that kind of grotesque comic quality.
They do. But sinister at the same time.
Yeah, very sinister. I mean, yeah.
So they have been in since the mid-70s, and they're presiding over a country where there's basically an urban, you could almost call it a low-level civil war. There's kind of guerrilla movement, the Montoneros, who are setting off bombs and kidnapping people and all this kind of stuff. They also have inflation that is, I mean, crazy levels. So, you know, three digits.
And so that's impoverishing the middle classes.
Exactly. But also, I mean, also it's impossible to, for the working class, it's impossible to buy anything because the prices are going up all the time. There are constant problems with strikes. So they've got this kind of economic basket case. And they have an ideology, which anybody familiar with Latin American post-war politics will know. It's just almost, which is quite fascistic. Mm-hmm. So it's all about kind of the nation, manhood, threatened by, you know, poets and left-wingers and communists. And yeah. The Americans, of course, are
right.
pouring money in to yeah. keep those because they're terrified of communism. And they have this kind of Operation Condor, which is all about, you know, training their secret police, training their intelligence services in suppressing dissent and all this. It's very dodgy. The dirty war label is well deserved.
And so General Galtieri, who yeah. becomes head of the junta in early 1982.
Yeah, the turn of 1982, exactly. So he's the head of the... What's happened in the junta, by the way, is they have inter-service rivalries. So the Army, the Air Force... Navy, they kind
so
of hate
adding
each other
to the fun.
And that adds to the chaos.
Yeah.
So Galtieri, who's of Italian descent,
but trained at West Point, I learned.
But trained at West Point, and yeah. they're all very pro-American. So one of the subtexts for the Falklands War, the Argentines are absolutely convinced that the Americans will back them. Mm. It doesn't occur to them that the Americans will not back them. So Galtieri is coming at the beginning of 82. And so actually what the Argentine armed forces, I didn't really go into this massively in my book, but this is such a fascinating aspect of the story. The Argentine armed forces wanted a war at the end of the 1970s, but actually Britain wasn't their first choice. Their first choice was Chile.
Yeah, they hate the Chileans, don't they?
They hate
the Chileans hate them. And that's
and
going to be an important part of the story too.
To outsiders, those regimes look pretty much identical. So you've got General Pinochet in yeah. Chile, and you have Galtieri and his kind of cronies in Argentina, but they absolutely despise each other. And the Argentines really wanted to have a war with Chile about the Beagle Islands and the division of the border in Tierra del Fuego. Yeah. I mean, that really would be the definition of
but it's kind of American backed fascists wanting to fight one another. So they can't back the American backed fascists in Chile, so they choose the American backed fascists in Britain. Right?
Oh, very good, Tom.
Okay,
very good.
Right,
very good. That's very the young ones style, unless it's...
So we've got Galtieri at the head. He's trained at West Point. He's yeah. American backed, and then we have Admiral Jorge Anaya, who is right. head of the Navy.
Yeah,
so he's.
But Galtieri has no brain at all. So,
but they're pals, aren't they?
They've been pals since their days at military college, and Anaya, who is the he's the brains of the junta. And he basically says to Galtieri at the beginning of 82, you know, the regime is a shambles, the economy is a mess in Argentina. What we need to do is we obviously need a very crowd-pleasing gesture. And in 1 year from now, it will be the 150th anniversary of the moment when these pirates stole the Islas Malvinas. So we can get these islands back before them.
The reason he thinks that is because he looks at Britain and he sees a country basically in chaos.
Yeah, well, this is the other aspect, isn't it? So okay. We've done Argentina, we've done the Falklands, okay. And we should...
So let's take a break now. And when we come back, we will look at the political context in Britain in the build-up to the invasion of the Falklands.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to The Rest is History, and we are talking about the Falklands War, which happened exactly 40 years ago as we record this in late March 2022. This mini-series will stretch out over 4 episodes, with episode 2 coming tomorrow, that's Tuesday, episode 3 on Thursday, and then the final episode next Monday, so next week, on the 4th of April. Although, of course, if you can't bear to wait for that, and you're a member of the Rest is History Club, you can listen to the whole thing already. RestIsHistoryPod.com to join. Now let's look at Britain. It's not in a happy place in 1982.
Why do the Argentines choose, why do they think they can get away with invading the Falklands or snatching them from Britain? Well, they look at Britain as everybody else does, and they think Britain's a complete basket case. So what's happened in Britain has been, let's say, 14 years of tremendous political and economic turbulence. I mean, I know people have different views about whether the 70s were brilliant or whether they were terrible, but Britain has devalued the pound. It has had a series of governments that have fallen after conflict with the trade unions. It has had a bailout from the International Monetary Fund. It has had endless problems with strikes and trouble between the governments and the unions. It has got the issue of Northern Ireland and the IRA bombing campaign and so on. Mrs. Thatcher was elected in the summer of 1979, first woman prime minister, conservative, on this sort of promise of radical medicine to cure the disease. And what's actually happened is that the first sort of 2.5 years, everything has just appears to have got immeasurably worse. So we did a podcast, one of our early podcasts was about 1981. 1981 in Britain is a pretty awful year. Unemployment through the roof, riots, yeah. Inner city riots, IRA hunger strikes in Northern Ireland.
Although the ashes. So
we did beat Australia to get the Australia, it was Botham's ashes, exactly. Yeah. But by and large, it's been politically a time of enormous turbulence. Margaret Thatcher, to most people, appears an aberration, an anomaly. You know, this mad woman whose popularity has reached depths unprecedented in polling history. So she's the most unpopular prime minister since records began at the end of 1981. The Conservatives are in third place in the opinion polls. There's a new party called the Social Democratic Party, which is leading the opinion polls. And I think if you're an Argentine general, you look at Britain and you say, well, Britain is weak. It lost its empire. It's had a shambolic last 10 years. It has this mad woman. I mean, a woman as prime minister, unthinkable. There is obviously no way that the British will do anything. And even if they try to, who cares? No one will back them. They're just a dead, you know, busted flush.
One of the things that obviously that Mrs. Thatcher and her government are trying to do is to claw back on spending.
Yeah.
And the Ministry of Defence, you know, this is the Cold War, so there's quite a lot of spending on defence. Mrs. Thatcher has initiated a review, am I right, that particularly targets the Navy?
Well, they have to cut something. So she's desperate to cut spending because of her sort of her political and economic agenda, and to sort of cut Britain's deficit. And in January 1981, she has brought in this guy called John Knott, who I know you like this line, Tom. He looks like a man who should have been a Bond villain's accountant.
I do like that line. Yes. But had been in Malaya, is that right?
In the Gurkhas. He'd been an officer in the Gurkhas. So
as I learned yesterday from Twitter when I put this out, Tony Hart, who was on Vision On.
Yes,
the guy. I mean, nothing to lots of listeners.
But. No, but the guy who would instruct children on. I never liked Tony Hart's programs because I liked
paint and draw.
I felt that it was very, even at the age of sort of 4 or 5, I felt that it was too worthy, and I really wanted to be watching. Obviously, Paddington, Tom.
Well, I was a big fan, and his best friend was a plasticine man.
Well, Morph.
Called Morph.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're slaloming off piece here.
But
one of the reasons why I mentioned John Knott, who, I mean, he absolutely does look like a kind of villainous accountant. You're completely right. And a lot of the kind of Tory grandees in Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet do. They, you know, thick glasses, kind of balding, spindly. Yeah. You feel, you know, they wouldn't be a good hand in the fight. But almost all of them have won the Military Cross or something
right.
in the Second World War. I mean, so lots of the people in Mrs. Thatcher's government are war heroes.
They are.
Decorated war heroes.
Willie Whitelaw, Lord Carrington, all the sort of the
Lord Carrington is the foreign secretary. Whitelaw is Home Secretary.
So we'll come to Lord Carrington in a second because he's really important, but I'm not. So John Knott has been told, I mean, this, by the way, would be music to the ears of Argentina's government if they'd sort of been following, if they'd been reading all this. So Knott basically is told cut defence spending. They have the choice of cutting the army in West Germany, the British Army on the Rhine, or the Navy. And their basic attitude is precisely as you say, Tom, because it's the Cold War. Well, we need the army on the Rhine, but the Navy is neither here nor there. So he says, well, let's get rid of most of the fleet. We'll shut the dockyards. We've got 3 aircraft carriers. We'll get rid of 2 of them, Hermes and Invincible. We'll close the dockyards in Gibraltar. We'll shut a lot of the stuff in Portsmouth. Get rid of it. You know, just close it all down. And one of the things that they say let's get rid of is this ice patrol ship, very important, called the Endurance, which is basically like an antique that just sort of potters around by the Falkland Islands as this sort of it's barely a deterrent. It's a totem of deterrence rather than a deterrent in itself.
But Lord Carrington, who is the Foreign Secretary, he does understand that this might signal a certain degree of weakness to Argentina. And he does kick up a fuss. And you say about this that the decision to scrap Endurance, which Mrs. Thatcher goes ahead with, was one of the most expensive she ever took because effectively it serves to green light the invasion. Is that right?
Yeah, I suppose the analogy that I give is that it's like getting rid of a burglar alarm on your house. If there are burglars on the other side of the road watching, you come out and very publicly start to dismantle your burglar alarm.
Yes.
You could say, I mean, the burglars are still at fault, and you still have the right not to be burgled. But it is, you would argue, it's foolish. That's basically what Lord Carrington, the Foreign Secretary, says. We shouldn't get rid of it, even if it's a bit, it's not that expensive. Mm. He says it's cheaper than having the Argentines invade. Now, the thing is, Lord Carrington, since he became Foreign Secretary in 1979, has been saying to his government colleagues, I think the Argentines, you know, they're rattling their sabres a little bit too loudly. And I don't think deep down he really believes the Argentines are going to invade because that would just be such a lunatic thing to do. But he sort of says they could, you know, we should be on our guard. Now, some listeners will, especially overseas listeners, and if we have Spanish-speaking listeners, will be saying, oh, the Brits, they just, you know, they're dyed-in-the-wool imperialists just clinging on to their colonies and all this. This is absolutely not the case with the Falkland Islands.
Yeah, they're desperate to get rid of them.
We were desperate to get rid of them because they're expensive. You have to keep sending them stuff. They're miles away and they don't really, you know, we don't need more sheep. And we don't need wool.
Isn't there a plan to give all of them £1 million?
Well, that comes later.
To persuade them to
That comes
to
later
leave.
On, yes. One of Mrs. Thatcher's key economic advisors, Alan Walters, did say later on, it'll be much cheaper if we give them each £1 million and get them to leave than fight to get their islands back for them. But so Britain wants to do business with Argentina. So the Foreign Office is, when the Foreign Office looks at this, they say, listen, yeah, we want to trade with Argentina. They're actually a friendly country because, you know, they're on our side in the Cold War. The Falklands issue is getting in the way, and it's much better persuade the Falkland Islanders, who rely on Argentina anyway. You know, if you need medical treatment, you're flown to Buenos Aires. You know, the flights go through there. You know, they get stuff from Buenos Aires. Why don't we just persuade them that it's in their interests to have a relationship with Argentina? And they basically cook up this plan in about 1980. And the plan is they know that the islanders don't want to just be handed over. So Mrs. Thatcher sends one of her junior ministers, a guy called Nicholas Ridley, very famous for smoking and not liking the Germans.
Yeah. And the grandson of the architect, Sir Edward Lutyens.
Ed Lutyens, exactly. So very aristocratic. They send him over to the Falkland Islands, and he's got to sell the islanders this thing, which is basically, they'll do a deal with Argentina where Argentina will get sovereignty over the Falklands, but they'll basically rent them out to Britain to administer for them so that the islanders can still feel that they're being run by the British and that the Union Jack is flying and stuff. And that'll be like a 99-year lease or something.
So like Argentina, Hong Kong.
Yeah, like Hong Kong. But Argentina will be able to say, oh, we've got them back. They're ours.
Yeah.
And Ridley goes over and he has this sort of public meeting and people say, no, you know, they don't like it. We don't want to be Argentines. We hate the Argentines. We hate you.
And he's fabulously rude, isn't he?
He is very rude. He says,
he's kind of a posh nicotine smoker.
So he basically says, at one point they shout, it's an amazing exchange. So somebody shouts from the audience and he says, what are you going to do if the Argentines invade? And Ridley says, oh, I'll kick them out. And they all laugh at him mockingly. And he says, well, we would kick them out if they invaded. But then he goes on to say, he says, well, that's not the issue. He says, the problem is, do you want the Argentinians invading you and us kicking them out in a state of a perpetual war? It's all very well sitting here saying someone else must come and kick the Argentinians out. Of course we would. But is that good for sheep farming, for fishing, for looking for oil, for your futures, for your children, for your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren? Is that the way you want to live? This is what you've got to think about. So he explicitly says this to the islanders. And the islanders basically say, get out. We hate you. We want to stay British. And when he leaves, do you know what they do? As his plane is leaving, they mount a loudspeaker playing Land of Hope and Glory. This land is our land and we shall not be moved.
Right. So a triumphant diplomatic foray. Do you think it might have worked out differently if he'd been more of a diplomat? Because he gets sacked. He gets sacked later on, doesn't he, for insulting Chancellor Kohl?
Yeah,
and calling him a Nazi.
Yeah, he does. He said the European Union was a German racket to take over Europe. I actually think even if they'd sent someone more emollient, the Falkland Islanders would have eaten them alive. I mean, the Falkland Islanders are farmers, and they're sort of plain speaking. But also, here's the thing: it's not just atavism and sort of, you know, prejudice that the Falkland Islanders don't want to be Argentinian. The Argentines, at the moment that Ridley is speaking, are kind of electrocuting, you know, folk singers and kicking people out of helicopters into the Atlantic Ocean. So the Falkland Islanders say, what the hell? Why would we want to be part of that regime in charge?
Okay. So the aspiration of the British government to save money by getting rid of the naval forces in the South Atlantic and trying to persuade the Falklanders to go over, I guess, again, must kind of add to the sense in Buenos Aires that the British are not going to, they don't really care. They're not going to fight over this.
British and are getting rid of their ice ship.
And so they start to prepare an invasion. But then there is, and this is kind of where the element of the comic and the farcical intrudes. We've mentioned South Georgia. What happens there? Just as the Argentinian Navy is preparing its invasion.
So this is so weird. This really is so weird. So the Argentine Navy basically construct this plan in the early months of 1982. What they want to do is they want to attack in the latter part of the year. So when the weather is so bad, because obviously the seasons are reversed in the South Atlantic, they want to do it when the weather is so bad. And obviously, British defence cuts will start to be kicking in. So the British cannot send a task force to retake the islands. And had they done so, Tom, that probably would be it. Because what would happen is that such a long time would elapse before the British could then get a task force together that there'd be some sort of diplomatic fudge.
Well, but also the islands would be so strongly fortified by then.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's a no-brainer from the Argentine point of view, but completely bizarre. And they'll do it in time for the 1983 anniversary, so they'll have crowds on the streets. It'll be great. From the completely bizarrely, a sort of separate part of the Argentine Navy decides that they'll also mount this sort of stunt on the island of South Georgia, which is, you know, as we said, hundreds of miles away and is the base of the British Antarctic Survey. And they decide they'd like that as well. And what they'll do is, South Georgia was always very big for whaling, and there's a sort of whaling station and oil processing stuff just lying about, loads of scrap metal. At the end of the 70s, an Argentine guy called Constantino Davidoff basically applied to the British Foreign Office and said, can I come and take away all this scrap metal and sell it in Argentina? They were like, yeah, great. So he makes one trip with all his scrap metal men, and they behave very badly on the islands. They make a mess, and they put graffiti everywhere, and they just, you know, the people of the British Antarctic Survey.
And they roast a reindeer, right?
Well, that's the second group.
I mean, that's shocking behavior.
Davidoff actually went to the British Embassy and he formally apologized, said, we behaved very badly. That won't happen again. Can we come back and get the rest of the scrap metal? Yes. So back they come to get the rest of the scrap metal. Now, in the interim, what seems to have happened is the Argentine Navy got hold of the fact that he was going and said, we'll give you ships. You can take some of our men with you, you know, in sort of paramilitary uniform, and then they can just seize the island. And that's great. That'll be a great hoot. And there's nothing the British Antarctic Survey can. So as you say, Tom, they go along in March, dressed as disguised as scrap metal dealers, and they barbecue a reindeer.
Well.
And this draws the attention of the British Antarctic Survey, who are sort of open university men with beards, studying penguins or whatever they're doing, who come over the ridge and see these blokes in military uniforms eating reindeer. And they then send a message back, initially to the Falklands and then to London, saying, absolutely disgraceful behavior, even well, by Dominic, the standards of...
Dominic, I was reading your book yesterday, and I've done a lot of podcasts with you, so I'm very well attuned to your verbal rhythms and idiosyncrasies. And when I read the sentence about the roasting of the barbecuing a local reindeer, which was a protected species, even by the standards of South American scrap metal dealers, this seemed pretty poor form. And I thought, only that is such a Sandbrook sentence.
Well, it is poor form, Tom.
It is, indisputably. Yeah, you can't go around roasted barbecuing reindeer. Okay, so that's bad. And that snarls up
the Argentine plan completely.
Yeah, so they have to go early.
So basically what happens is news of this South Georgia fiasco gets back to London. And a lot of Tory MPs, but also the Labour Party, go absolutely berserk, absolutely disgraced by national honour.
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot of shouting in the House of Commons. Get rid of these scrap metal dealers. They're stealing our rock.
Barbecuing our reindeer.
Right, exactly. And they have, and the Foreign Office put up some feeble minister who gives a speech, and everybody shouts at him. And in the gallery is a man from the Argentine Embassy. And he sends a report back to Buenos Aires saying, oh my God, the British have found out what's going on in South Georgia. This is going to absolutely mess with our plan to invade the Falkland Islands. And so the Argentine military have a big meeting on the 26th, I think it is, or 25th, 26th of March. They had a series of meetings. They basically say to the people planning the operation, you know that operation you're going to do in the autumn? Can you do it in basically 3 days? And they say, sure. So on the 26th of March, the junta make the decision, fine, we'll invade it now. Because if we leave it any longer, the British will send, you know, they'll be dealing with South Georgia. There'll be lots of ships. It'll be a mess. We've got to do it right away. And so it's very Russia and Ukraine. They, on the 28th of March, they tell all their troops who are conscripts, you're going on a very big exercise. They load them all onto these troop ships, and they've got crates of Argentine flags for them to hand out to the islanders, who some of the conscripts believe will be delighted to be liberated from the British, because that's what they've been told.
The British yoke.
And off they go, sailing. And the British have no idea that this is coming.
The representative of the British government on the Falklands is a man called Sir Rex Hunt.
He's a splendid fellow. I love Rex Hunt.
Who you describe in your book, again, quotations are so good I can't help but cite them, a bluff, jolly, stocky fellow, as if playing a British colonial governor in a Peter Sellers comedy.
Yeah. So Rex Hunt is this, right. So Rex Hunt is in his mid-50s. He's a sort of short fellow. Exactly that, Tom. He looks like a man who plays the governor of some godforsaken island that no one's really that bothered about.
On the Falkland Islands.
Yeah, because he would be played by Sid James. So Rex Hunt is not a star of the Foreign Office by any means. And somebody has said at some point, what will we do with old Rex? we'll send him to Stanley. Send him to the Falklands. He'd love it out there. And Rex Hunt likes flying. And he thinks, well, I can do a lot of flying, amateur flying. And he goes to the Falkland Islands to be the governor with his wife, Mavis. And they live in this sort of Victorian, it looks like a kind of Victorian farmhouse, which is the kind of governor's house.
He's very good at it, isn't he?
He's brilliant. He drives a red taxi, a London taxi, which is his official vehicle. It's just basically all he has to do is judge sheepdog trials and kind of have groups of the islanders over for dinner. And just sort of shake people's hands and be a sort of friendly guy, drink cups of tea.
So it's like being a kind of local laird in a...
Exactly.
Borders. Or something.
It's exactly what it is. And he's very good at it. The Foreign Office had said to him, yeah, it'd be very good if you could tell these chaps their future lies with Argentina. And actually, when he gets there, he is completely converted to the Falklands.
So he goes native.
So he goes native. And the Foreign Office are very displeased with him. The story is incredible. So on the Wednesday night, so I think that's the last night in March, the local magistrate had retired and Rex Hunt had had the bigwigs, such as they are, of the Falklands over for dinner. And they'd watched a film about the Falklands, an ITV documentary about their own islands called More British Than the British. And they loved it. They thought it was absolutely brilliant. It was all about how they had tins of Spam flown in and they ate Mars bars and all this sort of stuff. So he's had a big night. He gets up. His son Tony is home from boarding school and they finally got Tony to do his project or his work. So that's good news. And he does a bit of paperwork. This is Thursday. He has lunch, Mavis, Tony, Rex.
Coronation chicken.
And then at 3:30, the radio operator whose office is in Government House comes and knocks on the door and he says, we've just had this telegram. And the telegram says, we have apparently reliable evidence that an Argentine task force will gather off Cape Pembroke early tomorrow morning, the 2nd of April. You will wish to make your dispositions accordingly.
And is that coming from British?
That's coming from London. Yeah. So that's basically like, oh, by the way, you're about to be invaded tomorrow morning. You know, do what you have to do. And Rex Hunt, who... up till this point has never had, he has his sort of Zelensky moment. This is what this, so he basically says, right, burn all the classified papers. He rings around. He says, cancel the schools for tomorrow. There's a Royal Marine garrison with 69 people. And he tells them, they say, well, we'll mount our defense here in Government House in this sort of big Victorian house. So he sends Mavis and Tony off to stay with some friends. Although, not until they've had their dinner. So they still stay for dinner. Good. They have dinner.
So that's very carry on.
They have a family dinner. Then they go off to stay with friends. The Marines are now moving in all their kit. And Rex goes off to get his shotgun. And when he goes to get it, he finds that his chauffeur, the man who drives the taxi, is there, got there before him and is just loading it. And this driver says to him, I've left the flag up tonight, sir, and I'll shoot any argy bastard who tries to take it down. And Rex Hunt is so moved by this that he has to turn away to hide his tears. He thinks this is such a splendid moment. So, but then this is the single detail of the entire Falklands epic that I find most extraordinary. He then goes to bed and has like a sleep. Well, and you would think that most people would be shaking with nerves, but Rex Hunt, no, he has a sleep. He wakes up again at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 in the morning. The place is now full of Royal Marines and he's got his gun. He has another message from the Foreign Office. The Foreign Office say, we've tried to ask Ronald Reagan to intercede with the Argentines, but no joy. The Argentines are on their way. And then at about 5 a.m., Rex hears these colossal bangs and explosions. The Argentines have clearly landed, and they've opened fire on the Marines. And suddenly, there he is in the middle of it. You know, there's all this shooting going on, and they're basically, they're under siege.
And on that literal bombshell,
oh, very good,
Tom. I think that we should take a halt.
Okay.
And continue this gripping, epic, heroic, comic narrative tomorrow. So we will see you tomorrow, and we will talk about how the Falklands fell and what the reaction was in London.
Brilliant. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.